Please, sir, I want some more.
More? Of course, young Oliver. Here. This is Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green, and it's the last half hour. And this week, the bowl.
I want a little sugar in my bowl.
So filling our bowl will be chef and storyteller Tony Tan. Tony, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Fried rice is where we begin.
Well, for any one of us who's listening out there, fried rice is really one of those really very intrinsic parts of Chinese culture. So, you know, and it's also a really very easy way of making sure that you've got leftovers and turning these leftovers into something that's really very spectacular. But the ones that you usually find in Chinese restaurants or Cantonese restaurants is called Yongzhou Chao Fan, meaning to say that it's actually from a town in China called Yongzhou. And so that's the classic fried rice that everybody knows, which has, of course, leftover rice, Chinese sausages, and fried egg or mashed up egg that's in there, and spring onions. And then you toss that in a wok. And of course, there's a secret behind it, and you've got to make sure your fried rice has got that wok hei, or the fragrance of the wok that everybody knows about.
So how do we create that? What is the secret of that secret?
Okay. What you need is you need a really very hot wok. You would have it cut up all the ingredients that you need, like the ones that I've just mentioned, meaning to say you've got your Chinese sausage, you've got your egg ready to go, you've got your spring onions ready to go, and then you go through the whole process of cooking it. Generally, this is what I do at home, and that is I scramble my egg, lift it out or push it by the side of the wok. Then afterwards, then I put in the rice, and I've got to sort of very, very nicely toss the rice until it picks on that wok hei, meaning, you know, that fragrance that you need. Then after that, I put in my lap chong or my Chinese sausage, and then I put in my spring onions and a little bit of soy sauce and sesame oil, and that's all there is to it. So it's really easy. That having said, then there are also other things that goes into the bowl, because, I mean, you know, being traditional as well as creative, there are fried rices made with bakala or salt cod, and that comes from Macau. And so if you ever go to Macau, there's fried rice with bakala or salt cod and olive oil. So it's actually quite something else.
The world is full of fried rices. Tony, thank you. We'll be back with more for our bowl in a moment. Dr. Charles Spence is a professor of experimental psychology at the University of Oxford. Charles, welcome.
Thank you.
As I hold a bowl in my two palms, what goes through my mind?
So when you're holding the bowl, there are a number of things, some conscious, some less so, that are probably influencing your experience, both of the food, but also of the environment in which you find yourself. So when we look at it, we think about everything from if you're having, say, some hot noodles or a soup or porridge, then you may feel the warmth of the food through the bowl. And that has been shown that if you feel something warm in your hands, the world looks like a warmer place. People seem warmer to you. So that's good for a start. Then I think about how heavy that bowl might be and how pointless it is in a way that we normally eat from plates that are just left lying there sort of flaccid on the table. Because we've done a lot of research with bowls, with cups, with glasses, with beakers, with mugs, you name it, with cans, with boxes of chocolates, where we find that if you add weight to the packaging or the plateware and you feel that weight, then your brain doesn't do a very good job of separating the food from the plateware. And the heavier the bowl, the more satiating, more filling you think the food inside that bowl will be. And then looking a little bit further forward, once we've got more people holding their bowls rather than leaving their plates on the table, we're thinking about not just the temperature, not just the weight, but also could you add some texture to the outside of that bowl? And what might that do to your experience? And we've just come up with some bowls with like a very almost sandpapery finish on the outside, And the idea is, again, that you'll hold that bowl, and that very rough texture, we know, tends to bring out kind of the spicy notes, the gingery notes. Say, maybe if you've got a Thai green curry, it could be a quite different experience from the bowl in the hands than from a plate on the table.
What a wonderful way. I mean, this is us sensing our food, is giving this manual dimension to it and the associations that brings. And as you say, it's such a different process to that other one of laying things out coldly on that plane in a plate before us. Here is a thing that we touch, we have connection to.
In a way, I think that everything around the eating experience, from the cutlery to the plateware, is all sort of increasingly up for grabs as we think, we sort of question the way things have been done and how we can bring design more intelligently in to make sure that cutlery, plateware, bowls do kind of optimize our experience of whatever we eat with or from them. And it's kind of a really exciting kind of combination of design, kind of psychology, gastrophysics, that's where I come in, sort of the measurement of what plateware does to us, together with sort of the chefs and the experienced creators who are themselves getting more interested in not just serving everything on a big, white, round American plate.
Ideal bowl size and texture for porridge?
One might think, I guess porridge is probably better for you than some other things. So in that sense, while normally you say kind of the smaller the bowl or plate, the better, because that kind of tricks your brain into seeing there being to be more food. I would think also not just about the size of the bowl, but also does it have a rim or not? And I think, again, going with a rimless bowl for porridge or anything else is a good idea, because that, again, it makes it seem like that the food is more filling of the bowl, kind of flowing right up to its edges, whereas a rim kind of downsizes the apparent amount of food, so you might end up eating more. And then I think one other thing that's not really well designed, all my round white bowls at home are white, so if I'm eating porridge, I can't really see the porridge against the plate, and that really does matter. So you're looking to kind of optimize the contrast, the color contrast, to make that porridge look as vivid and delicious as possible, and so something other than white would probably be a good way forward.
Regular readers of Gwyneth Paltrow will be aware that the bowl is something of a fetishized object now, and the food that goes in it as well. I mean, I imagine you would find that entirely explicable.
Oh, yes, yeah, so always kind of easy after the event to explain things. Not that I predicted in advance that the world would change in quite this way and there'd be such a big uptake. From all the way through from Gwyneth Paltrow to the royal wedding here. Again, serving bowl food, I saw from the newspaper reports to the guests. I think it also plays into, in a way, kind of an informality around dining, more casual than formal. And the bowl sort of fits into that, whether you hold it or not. And also the kind of growing concerns amongst many about either healthy eating or sustainable consumption, and their sort of bowl, the idea of bowl food is kind of wrapped up in that. In some way, often the idea of, you know, sort of a substantial but healthy serving of something seems to go better together with a bowl or from a bowl than maybe from a more traditional type plate.
And I wonder too if in, you know, times of uncertainty and slight disorder that we crave that warmth, we crave the comfort of bowl food.
Yeah, and I think that's both. I mean, the one other thing to think about is if you do hold the bowl in your hands, not leaving whatever the plateware is on the table, then you will bring it closer to your nose. And I think that's really important because it also helps you to get more of the aroma from the food. And we know, or people will say at least, that 75 to 95% of what we think we're tasting, we're really smelling. And to the extent that is true, you think so much of our food design and delivery is so poorly thought out in the sense that most of the 95% disappears between the kitchen and your table. When the food is so far from your nose, it's really hard to get all the rich aromas. And the more you can smell the food, again, those sensations will convince you that you are fuller with less. And people have done this with soups, that you get people eating maybe or satiated full with about 10% less soup, the more aroma that you can get them. So it's that warmth, the fillingness of the aroma doing its work, but also the fact that bowls are round. So in those times when you're looking for something comforting, comforting things are more likely to be round than they are to be angular and pointed. So again, it's sort of playing in there. You can see the bowl is round, but you can also feel it. So it's kind of a multi-sensory comfort in a way. If it's warm, it's round.
It's sort of like eating mothering, really, isn't it?
Yeah, you could say that.
Charles, thank you so much. And the bowl, such a handy receptacle for focusing all those good things around our snout and mouth. Dr. Charles Spence, Professor of Experimental Psychology at the University of Oxford. Tony Tan's joined us, chef, writer, and filler of bowls. On this occasion, Tony, ramen.
Right. Well, ramen, as you know, has really taken the world by storm. I mean, you know, if you ever see the film Tampopo, you know, which it's about, you know, somebody, a Japanese woman who is really very crazy about ramen. And then, of course, there are people like David Chang, you know, the superstar chef, and Ivan Orkin, you know, they are the ones who really sort of made ramen something into something that is really very sort of ought, so to say. Mm. But it isn't really that ought, if you know what I mean. And that is, you know, if you go to any ramen shop, you know, you'll find that there are different kinds of ramen. But basically what you really need is you really need very good noodles. And a good ramen noodle has got this kind of springiness about it. So when you're eating it, it's got that what is called the al dente chew, you know. And so when you're having your different kinds of soups with it, you know, a lot of people virtually sort of start slurping, you know, on these noodles. That's one thing that you've got to look out for. And then, of course, there are different styles that come from different parts of Japan. And then, you know, there are ramen that's from Fukuoka, and there's also ramen from Tokyo. There's also ramen styles from Hokkaido. Mm. So, you know, all of them create different flavors. And just like any form of cooking, it starts evolving, you know, and so much so that I was only reading about it a couple of days ago, and somebody said that there is ramen that's made with Parmesan cheese. And I was just thinking, gracious me, you know. But, you know, horses for courses, put it that way. So it's a little bit funny. But the traditional ramen, obviously, is, you know, if it is a tonkatsu ramen, meaning to say that it's made with pork stock, generally speaking, so it's nice and thick. And then, of course, you eat that with barbecue pork or char siu. And then there is, you know, whatever else that you want to, you know, you request, you know, when you go into a ramen shop.
Very accommodating.
Yes.
Ramen from Tony Tan. So that is a rather delicious sound. Yes, the other side of the bowl equation. You may ask yourself, and I have done this, where precisely do bowls come from? And here's an interesting thought. That's the receptacle you hold in your hand, gripping there in the cup of your palms. Could it be that bowls grow from handiwork as well? We wanted to discover this, and so we sent producer Buffy Gorilla into the wild to find bowls in the act of creation. Buffy, what did you see?
Well, Jonathan, I went up to visit Wingnut & Co., and it's owned by Oscar Mew and Anna Yeman, and he made the bowl in about 5 minutes.
Can I say that we were slightly disappointed? We wanted you to make a bowl.
I know, and I let you down.
Well, in a small way, but I suspect that Oscar's bowl was a superior object, potentially.
I think it was far superior. Mine would have probably been wobbly. Oscar does such a better job than I would have ever done.
This is because Oscar is a potter.
He is. So he's trained to do this. He did a great job and made a bowl very quickly, and it was very impressive.
His bowl was just clay?
Just clay. But he really focuses his attention on the size and the wall thickness, and he makes about 800 bowls a month as part of his business. So he is the ultimate bowl maker.
There you go. From mud to ramen. That's the story of a bowl. How do you make them? Oscar Mew from Wingnut & Co. He showed Buffy Gorilla how it's done.
So you need the clay to start.
Yes. So I'm weighing the clay. We use about 500 grams for a smallish bowl. So I'm just cutting it up to size. Yeah, that should do. ball up the clay.
Okay. What shape is that? Because it's not quite a ball.
It has a little peak, I suppose. It's like an onion shape.
What tools do you use?
Well, I have a sponge, I have a brush, I have a needle, and a thing called the kidney tool, used for shaping and drying the bowl, and also a trimming tool and a cutting wire. So I'm going to throw this onto the wheel, which is why it's called throwing. And I need some water. So you have to first center the clay. So you use a bit of water for it. So you pull it up, push it down until it feels like it's no longer moving.
And how do you know that it's centered?
Well, it doesn't have any wobbles. When it's perfectly centered, even though it's spinning quite fast, when you put your hand on it, it just feels very still. And in Japan, it's called killing the clay. So it's when it's centered, it's no longer wobbling around and very still.
So then you're putting your fingers into the middle of the centered clay.
Yes, I'm opening up. So you go down in the center and you have to think about how much you want to leave on the base, depending on whether you want a foot on the bowl or just want it flat. And in my case, I always like to put a foot on the bowl. So I'm leaving about a centimeter of clay left on the bottom. So you push in the middle and then sort of pull it towards you, so the clay is opening up and being pulled open. And then you have to compress the bottom to align the grains of the clay.
Did you say align the grains of the clay? Tell me more about that.
So clay has a grain, you can't see it, but when you don't compress the bottom properly, it tends to crack. So by aligning the grains, it makes it stronger, and clay also has a memory, so you're just making sure that it doesn't split open when you fire them. That's opening up, and now we can start to pull the clay up. So from the outside, using both hands, you start to form the wall of the bowl. And you can do that in a few goes. So you first want to get the height. Once you're happy with the thickness of the wall, you can open it up to the width that you want it to be. In this case, I might make maybe an ice cream bowl, so not very big and not too deep either.
Your hands are so steady.
Yeah, the whole time you want them to be quite stable, so I'm resting my right hand on my thigh, and then left hand side is often supported by my body, and also as much as I can, I have both hands connected for stability.
Fantastic.
Trim off the excess from the bottom. It's very important to have a smooth rim. Then I can chop it off.
Done.
Dr. Helen Veit is an associate professor in history at Michigan State University. Helen, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
When I think bowl, I think perhaps of a slightly liquid content, and I wonder how much that object, the fact of a bowl, determines what is cooked to put in it.
Yes, I think that's very true. I think for a lot of people today, when we think of bowls, we think of soups. Or we might think of cereal or maybe ice cream with some sort of a sauce. But actually, I think for many people around the world, a bowl is more of an all-purpose vessel that holds all kinds of different things and maybe holds combinations of things and sauces. But that association between liquid and bowl is a fairly unique one and maybe a fairly modern one too.
Do we know when bowls began?
As far as I know, they are one of the oldest vessels. As soon as humans became sedentary and started making pottery, I think bowls are among the first artifacts that we have.
And I guess given that they are so old and in a way primitive, there must have been times in our history when we put aside the bowl because that was not a civilized object.
Absolutely. In fact, if there's one hallmark of 19th century high fashion when it came to eating, it was having lots of different things on a dining table, most of which were not bowls, different kinds of plates, and maybe, you know, specialized serving spoons or special plates for special things and different forks and different utensils. But the whole point, I think, in a lot of that showing off was to show that the people who could afford to eat that way had moved beyond this very simple mixing all-purpose method of eating.
And that the mixing is the thing there too, because that would then determine what they were eating. It would be various things placed around a plate, you know, separated, not combined.
Absolutely. Doing that was relatively modern too. It's, if you're going to cook something, probably the most economical way to do it is to use one vessel and to mix everything together, to throw in scraps, to use up odds and ends. And so a bowl really fit well with the kind of economical, pragmatic cooking that most people throughout history have done. And so in the 19th century, people who could afford to do so did in many ways exactly the opposite. They might have fancy sauces with many ingredients, but the point was to show this command of resources that they could afford to eat all of these different things prepared individually.
So the bowl has a class element.
Absolutely. I think it has for a very long time. I think, you know, probably really starting, you know, in the last few hundred years, people who didn't have to eat out of bowls would use something else. But I think that may be changing.
Well, indeed, because now perhaps the thing that's changed too has been the nature of the bowl. We have big fancy ones now, which transcend some of that.
Absolutely, yes. Some really nice, huge tureens that are themselves fragile and take care and maybe are showing off in their own way.
And so I guess the bowl and it's you know, the ebb and flow of it in trendiness, that affects other food trends. So we have pasta coming in and out of vogue, all sorts of soups, as you say, and the bowl up and down with them.
Absolutely. In fact, now there's a whole category, at least in the United States, called bowl meals, where usually there's some sort of a grain base and usually lots of vegetables, maybe meats, but not necessarily, lots of different ingredients that are very customizable, can accommodate all sorts of people with different dietary restrictions. You can easily add sauces or other flavoring agents, so they're great for vegetarians, and are, I think, a radical departure from, say, mid-20th century eating styles, which were more meat and potatoes. That's very trendy right now.
Yeah, I mean, there is a healthiness in that return, isn't there? The meat and potato, that's on a plate. The bowl, suddenly you can do a lot more. Suddenly you can do a lot more variety within that confined little circumstance of the bowl.
Absolutely. And it's a way, too, I think, to make vegetables taste good. Mixing lots of things together, using sauces, all of a sudden vegetables become more interesting.
And well, I guess too, it's more economical with those costly animal proteins. You don't need a lavish big lump of meat. You can have little bits that might be cheaper.
Exactly, which is precisely as people throughout much of history have cooked, stretching meat or other animal products by mixing it with lots of other things. So it's, you know, potentially a win-win situation. Cheaper, flavorful, but not using a whole lot of animal products, and really adaptable for lots of different people.
Helen, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And this has been The Last Half Hour. You just heard from Dr. Helen Vaite, Associate Professor in History, Michigan State University. You also heard from Dr. Charles Spence, Professor of Experimental Psychology at Oxford University, potter Oscar Mew, chef and author Tony Tan. Producers Amira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Ari Gross. I'm Jonathan Green.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving.